Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today we have some major news about strides forward to help the homeless in our region. And then we have an interview with Amar Campanajar, the Democratic candidate running in the 50th Congressional District, with some updates on the latest twists and turns in that important race to fill the seat left vacant by the resignation of Republican Congressman Duncan Hunter, who resigned after pleading guilty to a federal corruption charge. So stay tuned for the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
El Cajon City Manager Graham Mitchell is challenging other East County cities and the County of San Diego to address the homelessness crisis as El Cajon has during the past year. At the January 25th City Council meeting, Mitchell told council members that the city has spent $640,000 in the past year on programs to help the homeless. El Cajon has 2.5 times more shelter beds per capita than the city of San Diego does, and East County's other 3 cities have no homeless shelters at all. Mitchell told the council, "We are doing far more than what our neighbors have been doing." While El Cajon has the most homeless people in East County, Mitchell voiced concern that La Mesa, Santee, Lemon Grove, and the County of San Diego are absent when it comes to sheltering the homeless. He said that El Cajon is willing to work with smaller cities to develop better services based on El Cajon's experience. Councilman Phil Ortiz wants to see a broader approach. "The city can't do this on its own," he stated. "I would like to see our neighboring cities and the county to come together to have a regional plan similar to that of North County." He added, "The state of California also needs to treat this like a crisis. While efforts by cities has been voluntary up until now, California Governor Gavin Newsom's Task Force on Homelessness has recommended a mandate to end homelessness. The task force has urged the state legislature to put a constitutional amendment on the November ballot. The measure would force cities and counties in California to take steps to provide housing for the 150,000 Californians who lack it or face legal action." East County Magazine contacted the governor's press office to ask if the measure would provide exceptions for small cities with limited revenues, such as Lemon Grove, or for cities that have already invested heavily in providing shelters, such as El Cajon, but the governor's office has not responded. El Cajon has East County's largest homeless population, with 787 homeless people, of whom 489 were sheltered, according to the 2019 point-in-time count conducted by the Regional Task Force on the Homeless last January. In La Mesa, 46 homeless people were counted. Santee and Lemon Grove each had 35 homeless people counted, and also found 224 homeless people in the county's unincorporated areas, and all of them were unsheltered. A total of 1,127 homeless people were counted in East County's 4 incorporated cities and the unincorporated areas. But the total is likely far higher, since homeless in some mountain and rural towns were left uncounted. This year's homeless count by volunteers throughout East County took place on Friday morning, January 24th. Results from that count will be announced in several months. Mitchell said that the city has 2 goals in addressing the homeless issue. One is to provide permanent housing for those who are in our community. The second is to address the impact of homelessness and the negative impact of homelessness, such as preserving neighborhoods, parks, or other municipal amenities. The city has funded 7 programs through El Cajon Housing Connections, the Crisis House nonprofit agency, a Way Back Home program through the Salvation Army, shelter services, and a Clean Streets program administered by the East County Transitional Living Center, and 2 task forces through the East County Homeless Task Force, under guidance of the East County Chamber of Commerce. This has been the clearinghouse of great ideas, says Mitchell. But up to now, El Cajon has been the principal funder of the task force and has not been able to get Lemon Grove, La Mesa, Santee, and the county to participate as equal partners. El Cajon's programs are showing positive results. The city has found permanent housing for 86 individuals and 55 households since 2017, working in partnership with the nonprofit Crisis House, acting as a housing navigator. In addition, the city funding of a program called A Way Back Home through the Salvation Army brought another 73 individuals back to their families across the United States, paying for bus or train fare and coordinating with family members to assure successful outcomes. Through the East County Transitional Living Center, or ECTLC, the city has paid for 2,000 nights of housing at a former motel converted to a shelter. ECTLC plans to expand so that it can open the door for 40 to 50 new families and over 100 children. The ECTLC also offers longer-term shelter services and job training to those individuals who make a commitment to follow its religious programming and rigid rules. But the city funds only the secular, not faith-based portion of the program. Bradley Russell, a homeless outreach worker at the McAllister Institute, which provides substance abuse treatment and education, has noted the ECTLC is not always the right place for every homeless person because those who need to stay longer than 4 weeks are not allowed to do so unless they take a Christian-centered lifestyle. The city has indicated it would consider funding a similar long-term program from a secular group if a proposal is brought to the council. Still, El Cajon is doing far more than its neighbors, including the county, which while it has given away some housing vouchers, it has yet to open any shelters for people without homes encamped along riverbeds, in parks, and on sidewalks across the unincorporated region. El Cajon's representatives make an average of 20 contacts with homeless individuals every week. The homeless people are offered services and contacts with other service providers. Many individuals and organizations have volunteered to help with outreach. Outreach also includes targeting homeless people who were recently incarcerated so that upon release, they have services or housing opportunities waiting for them instead of winding up on the streets. In addition, the city has done substantial cleanup around the city. In the past year alone, El Cajon has cleaned out 176 tons of debris from water channels, streets, sidewalks, parks, and creeks. Homelessness is on the rise for many reasons, including high housing costs, inadequate mental health care services, drug and alcohol addiction issues, domestic abuse, young people who have aged out of foster care with no family support network, and new laws requiring release of low-level offenders from prisons. A recent federal court case, Martin versus City of Boise, has now limited city's ability to stop the homeless from camping on public property. In the past, police and sheriff's sweeps cleared out homeless camped on sidewalks, in parks, and along riverbeds. But recently, the Supreme Court refused to overturn a Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision, which ruled that homeless people have a right to sleep in public places if no shelter beds are available. So, a punitive approach is no longer an option for communities grappling with homelessness. Mitchell hopes that more cities and the county will join El Cajon in taking a humanitarian approach to the problem by providing shelter, services, and a hand up to help get people off the streets and into homes. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Goetz.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM, Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. And today I am very pleased to bring back Amar Campa-Najjar, the Democratic Party's endorsed candidate in the 50th Congressional District. He's worked for the U.S. Department of Labor and the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. He owns a small business, and he lives in Jamul, in the district, unlike some of the other candidates in this 10-person race. Right. There's a couple of women in the mix. He came within 3% of defeating Duncan Hunter in 2018, and now that Congressman Hunter has resigned, Amar is one of 10 candidates running for the open seat. So, Amar, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me. Good to be back with you.
Yeah.
Happy New Year.
Well, same to you. A lot's happened since we spoke a few months ago. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of changes in some of these issues, so we appreciate you asking to come back in and update us on your positions on some of the things that are new. Mm-hmm. Let's start with border and immigration. I wanted you to clarify your position a bit on a border wall and immigration policies, and then we're going to talk specifically about some of the new things that the Trump administration has done recently. But right. I know when you interviewed with the UT, you talked about supporting a border wall in some places and not others, and also expanding legal immigration mm-hmm. as a means of reducing illegal immigration. Mm-hmm. Can you clarify exactly what you meant for our
sure.
listeners?
I think it kind of tracks what I've been saying for the past 3 years. Even if we go back to our past podcast together, you know, when we spoke last time, I talked about supporting the Gang of Eight bill, the Senate bill that had comprehensive immigration reform. And I think you can't have one without the other.
Right.
Even though security and immigration policy are separate, you have to have one with the other. The first part of this conversation needs to actually focus on immigration. And there's some myths out there, like, you know, when President Trump talks about how some, I assume, are good people and most are bad, my perspective is the complete opposite. 99.9% of the people who are here, who are immigrants, are good people. They contribute to our economy and way of life. Some of them serve in our country's armed forces. They're doctors and lawyers. They're our kids. They're American everywhere except for on paper. And we have to value their contributions. So talking about expanding legal immigration, like you talked about, the irony is that I actually agree with a policy position that one of my opponents proposed in 2013, and now he's running away as far as possible from that legislation.
Which policy was that?
Daryl Issa. Daryl Issa actually introduced a bill in 2013 to give 12 million undocumented people 6 years of status in this country, where mm-hmm. they could come out of the shadows, contribute to our economy and way of life, get right with the law. And
right. So it wouldn't be a freebie. It's not just a blanket amnesty.
Right.
They would have to maybe pay some fines or mm-hmm. do some community service or something. Mm-hmm.
And then that would be a starting point for some pathway to earn citizenship. Now he's running away from that record. Carl DeMaio is attacking him, calling it amnesty.
Yeah.
Which is ironic because the term amnesty was used pretty freely from, you know, the father of modern Republicanism, Ronald Reagan.
Ronald Reagan, yeah, exactly.
And it was the Democrats who actually were proposing the idea of a barrier or a wall. You'll remember that it was Bill Clinton who really talked about this in the 90s, and Obama and Senator Clinton at the time
how
were the ones.
Change. And you've said that you partially support a wall, but that you want to be smart about it and basically, if I understand it right, kind of rely on the Border Patrol to tell you where are the actual problems where they're having still a lot of illegal crossing, and maybe we put a wall there, but we really don't need it in the middle of nowhere mm-hmm. where there's physical barriers already that
right.
people can't get across.
Right. And for me, I believe in data-driven, evidence-based solutions that are really grounded in good governance. So of course, you have to bring in stakeholders to tell you what the best way to deal with our border is. And that means talking to the people on the ground there, talking to environmentalists about the environmental impact, talking to people who own property and the issue of eminent domain. I don't think we should erect a wall where there's personal private property. I think that's an infringement on people's personal property. So there's a whole host of things we have to consider when looking at the border. Security is one element of it, but the commerce part of it's also very important. The San Ysidro border is, I think, the busiest corridor in the Western Hemisphere, in the entire Western Hemisphere. So
correct.
We cannot neglect the commercial impact of the border and also look at the security impact as well. I think we need to have a mile-by-mile assessment, which is what I said in the Q&A, of the border,
yeah.
and look at the combination of infrastructure, part of that's physical barriers, and I don't really believe in expanding the current wall. I believe in renovating the one that we have already mm-hmm. and using personnel and technology to fortify our immigration and border security along the border.
Moving on to another aspect
sure.
of the immigration debate, deportations.
just in the last couple of weeks, we're seeing stories about soldiers who served in our military, but who were undocumented. They knew it when they let them into the military, and then they come back and they're deporting them. And now, in the last couple of days, as we're doing this interview, the Trump administration has announced a new policy that will deny citizenship to the children of certain U.S. military members born overseas, even green card holders. We're not talking just illegal, which is one thing, but even a green card holder who's here legally, they sign up in the military, they and their spouse, and if their child is born overseas, their child can be denied reentry now and denied citizenship. They have a right to apply, but there's no guarantee that it will be granted. Mm-hmm. Where do you stand on that?
I think that's something, coming from a president who dodged the draft himself and used bone spurs to excuse himself from serving in the military. The fact that he would look at a person who served our country and say that they and their children don't deserve citizenship when people who served our military have done more to earn their citizenship than me. I was born here. I got lucky.
Yeah.
But they earned it. And I think that's wrong. And that just begins to show you the draconian approach and really the lopsided and kind of unclear vision and perspective that a lot of people in politics, especially our president, has on the contributions of immigrants to our country.
Another thing that's, I find personally very troubling, I think a lot of people do, whatever one's policy may be about how we should treat people who are undocumented, there's a very troubling report just out that reports that thousands of children who were held in U.S. detention facilities have been sexually abused. And now ICE is shredding some of the records to try to cover this up. What can be done about that?
Well, don't separate children from their families, for one. These children and their parents are being held in detention for far longer than what is normally permissible, more than 72 hours, that's for sure. And that's because it's a personnel issue. We need to hire more judges to expedite and adjudicate these asylum claims, which are a constitutional right.
Healthcare costs are continuing to soar, especially for those people who are nearing retirement age. We're hearing all kinds of plans thrown out now by candidates. Can you elaborate on what your ideas are to make quality healthcare more affordable and accessible? And to point out how bad this is, I'll point out that the last time we spoke, I think I complained about my own healthcare going up from $500 a month to $650 a month. Well, it just went up again, $1,000 a month each. For my husband and myself, how is a middle-class family supposed to afford $2,000 a month?
Right.
And, I mean, there's still deductibles and everything on top of that. So what is your plan
to help folks like that? Yeah, no, it's absolutely an important question. And, look, I think it's important for people to understand that the president, whoever he or she may be in 2021, drives the agenda. And so what I want to do is look at healthcare for what it is and really humanize it, because people think about it in terms of this abstraction. But as you laid out, it's $2,000 a month for you. That's a lot of money for people, especially out in East County.
More than a mortgage.
Unbelievable. And you think about the reality of healthcare. I've said this before. Most of us in this world will enter this world through the healthcare system, and most of us will exit this world through the healthcare system, the hospitals. And how much time you have between those two moments of your life really depends on the kind of healthcare you have. And the price of doing business for those CEOs should not be your life. That should not be the price of business. Something between costing you your life and being free is what we should do, and make it to where it's affordable, where you can live, work, and retire with dignity. The problem we have today with our healthcare system is we pay more than any other country in the world. We've heard this before from many different people. And the reason is we have no oversight at all on how much we can jack up the cost of healthcare in this country. Meanwhile, the average tenure of a CEO of a health insurance company is 5 years. So they're trying to rack up as much profit as they possibly can, because they know they won't be around for the liability of it all.
Yeah, so, it's interesting that in California, if you're a car insurance company or a homeowner insurance company, you have to come before the insurance commissioner and justify why you need a rate hike. You know, your costs went up, say.
Right.
You don't have to do that for healthcare. The former insurance commissioner tried to get a law passed that would require that and couldn't get it through the legislature. Mm. And, of course, Congress has never even considered something like that. But it seems like kind of a no-brainer that they shouldn't be able to jack it up just as much as they feel like it.
Right. I think there should be a limit on it. And, you know, for me, my whole proposal is called CampaCare, which is to give consumers and patients as many choices as possible because only you know what's best for your family. I don't think it's a place for the political class or the Washington elite to tell you what's best for you.
So if you love your private care, yeah, you could keep you could it. Keep what it. If you hate your private care?
You get
like
to
I
have
do.
A you get to have a public option like Medicare, but not Medicare itself because it's not dipping into the senior benefits, or a nonprofit option like Kaiser. So you get to choose, and I think those choices creates competition, and competition drives down costs and increases the quality of care. And here's what I would say: there are people who support a certain type of narrow agenda. I think, you know, if we have a president who wants to do Medicare for all, and my camp of care is out there, meaning you have all the options, if people all gravitate towards one of those options, then that idea of healthcare will actually beat out the other two.
You know, I have mentioned to some people, the last time you were on, you talked about one aspect of camp of care that could either be part of a big plan or it could even be a little standalone build, at least fix a little part of the healthcare system right now, was the idea of allowing people that are approaching Medicare age, people like me, once you hit, say, 55, between 55 and 65, to have an option to buy into
Medicare. It earlier.
Yeah, pay a little bit. It wouldn't be free, but it would be more affordable than what we're being hit with right now as we get older and our rates are going up. And it's interesting. I've even talked to Republicans,
and
even
like
Republican office holders. They like that one. They've got the same problem, some of them, you know.
Yeah, I like to hear that Republicans are on board with that. That's what I'm hearing on the ground, too. And the beauty is even the most aggressive healthcare proposal of expanding Medicare for all, which I have my questions about. But let's just take the first 2 years of the plan. The Senate plan to expand Medicare for all is 4 years. Mm-hmm. The first 2 years, which is the first 2 years I'll be in office, it lowers it from 55 in the first year to 45 in the second year. So if I'm right and expanding that plan to people who are 45 and older works, guess what? I get reelected. And so does the person who's the occupant of the White House.
Yeah, and I misspoke before. You said 45 and up. Not 55 and
No, I did say 55 in the first year, then 45 in the second year. So,
okay.
So you're not wrong. But the idea of expanding it, and if people like the plan, I get reelected. If they don't like the plan, it gets wiped off.
Yeah.
And that's the beauty of this whole process, is we get to taste it and sample it before we buy into this idea of a public option in addition to a private and nonprofit option.
And then the other thing
that we don't talk about enough, Miriam, is and we've talked about this, is the cost of pharmaceutical drugs. Last time we were here, we were talking about how there was someone who died because they were rationing their insulin.
And it happens a lot.
It happens a lot in our district, and it's unfortunate. So being able to rein in the cost of prescription drugs, take those, you know, those sweetheart deals, those tax giveaways that we give, and those corporate subsidies we give to Big Pharma, and use that to lower the cost of prescription drugs, allow people to purchase Medicare to purchase medication in bulk so that the individual unit's cheaper. Just like when you go to Costco, you buy a crater of water versus one bottle.
Well, like the VA does that. They buy it
exactly.
in bulk. So how come, you know, it's great for veterans,
right.
but why don't they do that for everybody?
Exactly. And then last but not least is I think you have to decriminalize and deschedule medicinal or marijuana, just because we know a lot of we personally probably know wounded veterans and cancer patients whose lives were not just saved but extended because they were not in the throes of the opioid addiction that we see a lot of people in our district suffer from.
So, that's true, and also people with epilepsy.
Absolutely, yeah.
Moving on, in California, a big issue coming up right now is AB 5, which is a law that kind of turns employment law on its head. The goal of it was noble. I think it was trying to protect exploited workers, you know, maybe some Uber and Lyft drivers who claimed they were making less than minimum wage, but it's a little bit like killing a gnat with an anvil. It's so broad that now it's harming a lot of independent contractors who want to stay independent. Mm-hmm. People like musicians, writers, photographers, artists, translators, full disclosure, media outlets, including ours, small businesses, nonprofits that are now really struggling to stay alive and comply with these very complex and extremely expensive requirements. So there have been some rallies around the state. There was a big rally yesterday as we speak in Sacramento from people calling for this to be repealed, but also some Democratic presidential candidates now calling for a national version of AB 5. To be enacted in Congress, maybe well-meaning, again, they may not fully understand all of the implications, all of the ramifications of it. I would like to ask your views on AB 5, or more specifically, the prospect of a national version of AB 5 in Congress.
You know, I'll be completely honest. I've been very consumed with the national conversations about health care and the environment, the impeachment, the Iran situation, a whole host of issues that, since AB 5 is not really in my purview because it's a state issue, I haven't given it the kind of attention that it needs. But, you know, I'm a business owner, and I had, you know, independent contractors work under me in the past. So right now that I've downscaled my business, I don't have that need. But if I did, I'm sure I would be more informed, and I'm sure it impacts a lot of people who listen to your program, including you. I know it's well-intentioned because I know the author has always fought on the side of workers. And what I've heard is some people have some concerns. It needs some clarification of the legislation.
Yeah, I mean, do you think
because of the broadness of it? So
maybe minimum sizes before it kicks in. For instance, it would cost me $800 to make somebody an employee if I just need somebody to pass out flyers about an event for a couple of hours, which is obviously onerous, or to hire a musician to play an event.
I wish I could answer this question. I don't know if there's exemptions or not in the legislation, but
which
they may exist already.
To at least study
Absolutely.
Up on it before making a, you know,
and not only
knee-jerk.
That, I would encourage other presidential candidates to also read the bill before they sign on to any bill that's in the laboratory stages of being debated on or discussed or unveiled on a state level.
So I think, and meet with people maybe who are actually impacted.
Oh, totally. 100%. I mean, I think any person who is in politics should meet with people who are impacted by legislation. Even the Obamacare, for example, the Cadillac tax has been removed. No legislation is perfect in its beginnings. And I think the only way that you can make legislation better is by listening and learning and then, you know, leading on that. So I would certainly be open to looking at it. And hopefully next time we talk, I'll give you exactly what my two cents are.
Oh, that would be great. Thanks, Amar.
Of course.
The race has turned to sort of a mudslinging effort among two of your opponents, with Carl DeMaio bashing Daryl Issa as a snake oil salesman in his ads, and Issa's running ads with headlines about DeMaio being gay, which even the Republican Party leader, Tony Gravark, has said was not appropriate. And they're pointing fingers at each other over shifting stances on issues such as immigration, as you pointed out, you know.
I mean, their attacks, my response is they're not wrong about each other. They did support what they said they supported, and I'll let them just keep fighting it out, but I'll be the breath of fresh air, the positive candidate who wants to focus on the cost of living, healthcare, housing's a big issue, education, lowering the cost of prescription drugs, protecting Medicare and Social Security, which for some reason the administration's attacking now, and making sure that we have good opportunities for good paying jobs.
You're staying above the fray.
I think I'm going to be the adult in the room. I'm the guy that almost won last time, and I'm going to act as though I'm the runner-up for this seat now that Hunter's gone. I'll let them do the fighting.
Now, in your Union Tribune article, you were quoted as saying you would be the most conservative member of the San Diego delegation if you were elected. You got some criticism from some of your Democratic followers out there on that, on the social media. Yeah. Can you clarify what you actually meant by
that? You asked the question with a smile on your face because you understood I was being tongue-in-cheek, because if I'm in Congress, the whole delegation is going to be liberal. So it's a low bar to be the most conservative congressman county.
The other four are Democrats. Yeah, so you're saying you're conservative than the four.
Yeah,
Democrats.
I'll be more conservative than by the virtue that I live in Hummel and
red district,
and that I own a gun. Those two things, that's the bar that makes me more conservative than them. But it's also true that you can be both the most conservative congressman in the county and the most progressive congressman in the history of the 50th. Those are two, they're not mutually exclusive. So on certain issues like government reform, I actually went on KUSI and unveiled my program to my agenda to get corruption out of Washington. And on those issues, I'm very progressive, right? So
Do you want to take a second and give us a couple of the points on that?
There's 11 points. The first one is to introduce an amendment to overturn Citizens United to get special interest money out of our politics and to penalize corporations that try to illegally use campaign funds to help a campaign. You would penalize them with a tax penalty and use that funds, create a fund in our government to create voluntary publicly financed elections. That's my second point. So if you raise all your money from people who donate $200 or less, and 75% of your money comes from your state, you're eligible for a 6-to-1 matching donation.
And you're going to be answerable, presumably, to what the actual voters want, exactly, as opposed to what some special interest that might not even be centered in the district
just
wants.
Like the 9 pharmaceutical lobbyists that exist, there's 9 per member of Congress, and you wonder why the cost of pharmaceutical drugs are high, because they're well financed. And the other things I would do is, you know, you don't get to pass a bill until you read the dang bill. If you don't pass a bill, you don't get paid. Mm-hmm. You don't pass the budget, you don't get paid. Getting rid of the revolving door between agencies that are supposed to conduct oversight over industries and those industries. For example, 75% of the funds that the FDA used to research and approve opioid medications were funded by those same companies that stand to benefit from it. And that's why we have an opioid crisis. So getting rid of that revolving door, having a lifetime ban on lobbying, making sure that you can't sit on committee assignments if you are indicted for a criminal act like Hunter, making that a rule. And if you've recently failed the FBI background check like Congressman Issa did when he was trying to get that confirmation with the Senate, that you cannot sit on a committee assignment until you've actually dealt with that issue. So
yeah, that's an interesting point. I was kind of surprised that he's running for Congress here,
right,
given that President Trump had appointed him to a position, trade appointment.
Trade agency, yeah.
And the Republican-controlled Congress, or Senate, would not confirm Issa, because they said there was something so troubling in his FBI background check that they would not confirm him. Mm-hmm. And yet we still don't know what it is. It's being kept secret.
Right.
We don't know what it is, and yet we're being asked to ignore that and vote for him.
You know? And that's why I want to make sure, you know, I don't think he's going to get through me to get to Congress. But if you recently had you failed an FBI background check, you should not be able to be on sensitive committees where you actually might have information.
Yeah. And I would challenge former Congressman Issa that if he wants to come on the show and disclose what's in that FBI background check, we would be more than happy to talk about it and let him tell his side of it.
Right. Absolutely. And I think he'd be open to it if you could find time to meet with him. So, look, I think those are the kinds of reforms we need. Is there's 3 buckets: the campaign finance part, the conflicts of interest, and then fixing government, making sure that we have actual government reform. So you got to read a bill before you pass it. You can't write chicken scratch on it and then pass it like we did the tax plan dead of night.
I want to move on and talk about the environment a little bit. Since our last interview, Amar, the Trump administration has announced that it's rolling back clean air and clean water protections that were enacted over the last 40 or 50 years, even some things put into place under the conservative Nixon administration, but it's not. And these, they're saying, will affect our local waterways here and our air. They're also opening more and more public lands up to fracking, mining, logging, and other environmentally harmful practices, and even our national parks, our national forests, as well as Bureau of Land Management properties, some of them right here in East County. We have also just seen that they can't seem to get through Congress right now even a ban on these, what they call forever chemicals, the PFAS chemicals that never break down.
Right.
We've got a big expose I just put up on it now, but these have been used, among other things, in some of the firefighting foam. Mm. We're still trying to find out if it's still being used here. They're cancer-causing, very, very dangerous.
Right.
What would you be doing to try to push back against some of that, or do you agree with some of those
I don't agree with a single part of that. I think it's, again, you're having these special interests trying to shove their agenda down our throats, and you have a president who's willing to give them carte blanche. And this is a real serious issue. You don't have to look at liberals to understand the ramifications of climate change. You have to just ask the military. The DOD gave a report last year to the president saying that, quote, it was climate change is the biggest national security threat that we face on the face of this planet, bigger than Iran, bigger than ISIS, bigger than North Korea or Russia or anything else. And it's because we have 80 mission-critical military bases in mainland USA. 2/3 of those are not combat-ready because of rising coastlines, because of fires, droughts, hurricanes, mudslides, name it. So it is a real issue, and we have to make sure that the EPA, again, that revolving door, if you see who's actually the head of the EPA, has a conflict of interest.
Well, a lot of them do. A lot of these appointees are they're miners, they're hunters, they're oil company executives, coal company executives. Basically, we have foxes overseeing the hen house at the so-called regulatory agencies, every one of them right
Someone told
now.
Me, that why would you let the, what is it? Someone said, don't have the patients ruling the what is it called?
Running the asylum.
And I was like, that's exactly what's happening right now.
Yeah, that's
it's a like
good
a bizarro
analogy.
World version of government here.
Well, and to me, conservation used to be considered
right,
a conservative value. Mm-hmm. Teddy Roosevelt was the one who founded the National Park
right.
System. Richard Nixon is the one who started the Environmental
right.
Protection
right.
Agency. So to me, when someone says they're a conservative, but
so maybe
they,
in that respect,
but they want to pollute our water and our air and destroy our national parks. To me,
right.
there's nothing conservative about that.
Right. Maybe in that way, I would be one of the most conservative candidates running on that issue in terms of what used to be conservative, right? With Teddy mm-hmm. Roosevelt and the like, and
there
even Nixon. But here's what's really important that people don't understand. We do. We respect our open spaces. What makes East County so characteristic, what was so characteristic about East County is we love our natural heritage. We
yeah.
love our open spaces. It's who we are. We care about clean air and clean water. We want to make sure this world's inhabitable for the next generation. Ask people who've lost their homes in fires if the hots are getting hotter. Ask, you know, our firefighters if they want to be, they already are exposed to so many cancerous materials. We shouldn't be adding to it.
Yeah.
And, you know, everything from those EPA rollbacks to the public lands to threatening to not fund California's firefighters, all those things are an affront
yeah.
to our values, not just as Californians.
That's a terrifying one.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we have to be bold and stand up to this president when it's counter to our values and what we believe in. And right now, all my opponents, the Republicans, are just worshiping at the altar of Donald Trump. And you know what? He's not perfect. There's only one Lord and Savior, and he died on the cross 2,000 years ago. And Donald Trump is a far cry from that man. So hold them accountable when you need to. Work with them when you can, like with the USMCA or, you know, jobs or infrastructure. But hold them accountable when he's doing things that are counter to our nature, including, you know, hurting our environment.
You've talked about putting country over party to bring the district together and bring the nation together. I think maybe that's a good example of that, of looking to find what's good on both sides of the aisle and not just blindly having a knee-jerk support for something
right.
that comes from one party or the other. A couple of the big issues out here in East County and all over California right now, homelessness. There's
mm-hmm.
a Supreme Court decision now that makes it so that police are not allowed anymore to arrest people for sleeping in public places like sidewalks and parks and riverbeds if there's no shelters for them.
Right.
And yet some of the local cities don't have the money for that. If you're Little Lemon Grove, where
mm-hmm.
are you going to get the money to build a homeless shelter, you know? Do you think that there should be a little bit more help at the federal level for some of the smaller communities that are grappling with this? Is there room for a federal role here?
There is a huge role for a federal role in a lot of things that we need in California, and I'll tell you why. California is the fifth biggest economy in the world. We are the biggest contributors to federal taxes in the whole entire country in terms of a state. California, especially my district, we don't get what we put into the system. And I'll give you an example. San Diego County is the fourth biggest homeless population in the country.
Right.
And in terms of veterans, it's the second biggest homeless veteran population in the country.
True.
And yet we're 20th in HUD funding. So how are we fourth in need and 20th in supply?
So maybe just a matter of reallocation of
Absolutely.
Some of that funding
right.
from places that don't need it as much.
Right.
And being the squeaky wheel to say, we need that here.
Exactly. And so it's not even raising a single tax dollar to solve this issue. It's putting us in fourth place in terms of HUD funding, figuring out the formula, updating the formula that we need to fix the need for not just low affordable housing, but mid-level housing for workforce housing.
Yeah, another
because
big
that's
issue,
really
housing.
Important.
Very
because,
important.
You know, my opponent, Carl DeMille, thinks that mental health is the biggest contributor to homelessness, which is not true. 15% of people who are homeless are suffering from serious mental health issues. We just did data on homelessness a couple weeks ago where the governor came down to the
right.
county as well.
No, you're correct.
Only 15%. The rest are having it because of economic reasons, not just mental health issues. And most homeless people in San Diego are homeless only 6 months at a time. They're not chronically homeless. So they're trying. They're trying to keep their job. They're trying to make the rent. But, you know, the cost of living in San Diego, ask any person in East County, people who work multiple jobs.
Yeah.
We're struggling to keep it together. Of course, other people will struggle who have
sure.
less opportunity. And when you look at a homeless person and you look at them, and if they're a veteran, you shouldn't look down on them. You should be able to thank them for their service. Those people gave up their sanity for our freedom. And the least we can do is get them back on the right track. Not give them a handout, but give them a hand up. give them mental health services and vocational training, and yes, housing that we could afford by changing the HUD formula to be able to allocate more funds to the county.
Another issue we haven't talked about, but I'm hearing more and more from East County residents who are concerned about slow ambulance response times. It's not unusual to wait an hour, even on a major highway in a rural area, say along somewhere like Highway 94 or parts of 67 up in the mountains for an ambulance to get there, let alone if you're in the main part of town. I'm not talking about way out on a mountain by yourself. If the entire state of Missouri can have average response times of something like 8 minutes or so statewide, is it really acceptable for our county to consider response times of 30 to 60 minutes acceptable in rural areas? And what could be done at a national level to make counties invest more to protect lives during medical emergencies? Do we maybe need a national ambulance response time, for example?
That's a good question. A big part of and the reason that local first responders really supported the statewide measure to invest more in infrastructure was because infrastructure and our roads, fixing our roads, making it more accessible to get from one place to another, especially in rural parts of our district, is critically important to this. And that's why I was really encouraged on a national level that you had President Trump, Nancy Pelosi, and Chuck Schumer in a room together in the Oval Office, and they were this close to a $2 trillion investment in infrastructure that really would have, I think, done a great, great service to reducing those times.
Well, but that was infrastructure more like road building and bridge repair. It didn't deal with ambulance response times. You have the greatest roadway in the world, but if you don't have enough ambulances, which San Diego, quite frankly, does not.
No, I think obviously we have to invest in that as well. But what I've heard from first responders also is getting to the scene of the emergencies takes some time because of the infrastructure part. So
true, if it's dirt road or something,
And I live on a dirt road, so God forbid something were to happen in my house, it would take a while for them to get to where I live in Hummel. It's far away from a lot. But also, I think we should invest in more first responders. And that's why my whole plan is not just finding pathways to the middle class that are just based on college educations, vocational training for first responders, getting more of those folks, more of those personnel. So my plan in apprenticeship programs, for example, would be to invest more in different types of industries, including in the first responders and making sure we have adequate amounts of people.
Yeah, your ideas on jobs are interesting. And it's an area where you actually have some experience. Mm-hmm. You've promoted job creation and apprenticeship programs. When you worked at the Department of Labor in their public relations department there, can you just very briefly, we're a little short on time, but if you could just give us the thumbnail version of how you would bring good-paying jobs to East County.
Great, yeah. So here's what I would do. There's a program called Apprenticeship that we worked on. It's an Earn What You Learn program. The average apprentice makes $70,000 a year. That is more than double what people in East County make, well over, probably triple. So if you're able to make $70,000 a year, that means you're able to afford the cost of housing, healthcare, and education, good quality of life. That money circulates in the economy, and it's not, you don't have to go to college for it. You just go into an apprenticeship program that's given either by, it could be by a union or not a union in partnership with a community college or some other educational mechanism. And by the time you're done, you're making good amounts of money. And that's not just in manufacturing, construction. We're talking healthcare, transportation, hospitality,
finance. Yeah, we had $70,000 a year jobs. So maybe we could afford our healthcare bills, right?
And here's the thing. There's 6 million job vacancies in this country. Mm-hmm. Or 7 million job vacancies, and there's 6 million people looking for work. There's more jobs than there are people looking for work. Not all of them are good paying jobs, but we do have a skills gap. And if we filled that skills gap, then we could fill that jobs gap. Like you were talking about with first responders, we need to fill that gap to make sure that response times are quicker. Apprenticeships helps us do that in that sector and many other sectors too.
There you go. I'd like to talk about the Middle East. Since our last interview, President Trump has taken some major actions in the Middle East, including, somewhat controversially, ordering the killing of Iranian Major General Soleimani, which resulted in Iran retaliating by bombing U.S. bases in Iraq. And just yesterday, the news is out that it turns out that caused brain damage to about 40 or 50 of our American soldiers. And also, you know, there was the accidental downing of a Ukrainian plane, passenger jetliner. A lot of unforeseen consequences, or maybe things that should have been foreseen.
Right.
What are your views on the president's actions in that specific circumstance?
Yeah, so I think we knew that there was going to be a response after what happened in the embassy. My question has always been, you know, taking out Soleimani, somebody who has killed Americans, many Americans.
Yeah, definitely
Americans,
a bad guy.
But nobody mourns his death. But the question is, was it in America's best interest? Was it the right thing to do to take out Soleimani? And he wasn't the first president to be asked this question.
True.
George W. Bush also had his crosshairs on him, and he wasn't squeamish about War on Terror. He was the author of War on Terror. Same thing with Obama. Obama killed bin Laden. He has no reservations about taking out...
True, although bin Laden wasn't an official military officer of a recognized government, and that's what makes it different. Bin Laden was the head of a rogue terrorist organization.
Well, if you look at Libya, for example, that's maybe a more akin thing.
Yeah,
Basically, we went in there and we allowed... Libya to take out Gaddafi, and in a very grotesque way as well, if you saw the videos.
True.
But my point is, neither of them thought the cost outweighed the benefits. What changed? You know, he still was provoking and killing Americans, but we had a Republican president, a Democratic president who chose not to take action. And the question is, what changed? And that's a question that we've all been wondering. What was the imminent threat that Pompeo and the president were talking about? Now, thankfully, we found an off-ramp from the warpath, and Iran gave that to us when we found that nobody was killed when they bombed our base in Iraq. But here's the thing that's really troubling. The most troubling part of this to me is when President Trump said, you know, we're all good. He said, there's no casualties, just some minor headaches. That's brain trauma.
Yeah, that's not exactly. Brain trauma is not a minor.
It's not a minor thing. It could be something that's damaging for life. It's part of why 22 veterans a day claim their lives. It's part of why the VA is the biggest investor in research of brain trauma, more than the NFL. The NFL used to be the biggest until they found results they didn't like. But the VA now is, and that's how severe an issue brain trauma is to our veterans and surviving war heroes. And for the President of the United States, the Commander-in-Chief, to downplay something that wreaks havoc on the veteran community is unbecoming of a commander-in-chief. It is not the kind of service and leadership that we need in this 50th district. And any single person running for this seat who does not stand up on behalf of our veterans and call out Trump on his downplaying of the kind of harm that he put our men and women in Baghdad when it came to brain trauma, if they don't speak up vociferously, they are cowards and they don't deserve to serve our veterans.
This week, President Trump announced a proposal for a Mideast peace plan, which has drawn criticism from Palestinians and from some liberal Jewish people in Israel, although support from some of the conservative Jewish leaders. I'm curious, Amar, as a candidate who has a toe, really, in kind of multiple worlds of faith here, you were raised a Catholic, your grandfather was Palestinian, mm-hmm. or father was Palestinian. Your girlfriend's Jewish.
That's right. We're going to solve the Middle East issue with our children. That's our goal.
Get your family to sit down together.
That's right.
But I'm curious if you can share your perspectives on the Israeli-Palestinian situation and specifically what you think about the approach that President Trump is now proposing, if you've had a chance to look at that or analyze that yet.
Well, I look back at, you know, when President Bush worked on this. He had Prime Minister Olmert and Abbas working together. Bill Clinton, you know, famously had Barack and Yasser Arafat, and before Barack, he had Yitzhak Rabin. The picture is worth 1,000 words.
Mm-hmm.
And you look, you know, yesterday or the day before, whenever it was, you had President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu. Not a single leader from Egypt or Lebanon or Jordan or even the Palestinians. That tells you everything.
So it's one-sided.
It's unilateral. And it goes against everything that we've stood for in America in terms of our policy towards this conflict. You know, it's long been American policy to condemn any unilateral act of trying to deal with this issue, whether it was through the UN with the Palestinians. America was very critical of that. So to see this unilateral move with just the U.S. and Israel and no player from the Arabs' leadership at all, not the Palestinians or Lebanese or Jordanians, Egyptians, it just tells you it's not a deal. How do you have a deal with one side? Right, wrong, or indifferent? I didn't even go as far as to look at the details because I automatically knew it was dead on arrival.
You have to have both sides of the negotiating table to get
a
deal.
You have to. Yeah. And Bill Clinton knew that. Jimmy Carter, Bush, mm-hmm. they've all known that. And this is a huge departure from, you know, the bilateral posture that the U.S. has had on this conflict that's, you know, it's stumped everybody. And President Trump fancied himself a real estate person and thinks about this as just a real estate issue. Yeah. You know, it's just another series of things and a competitive selection of foreign policy blunders from this president.
Conservatives would say that one of the strengths, as they see it, from this administration is that the stock market is strong, the economy is booming. I would like to ask you, do you believe that a strong stock market adequately defines the full state of the American economy? Why or why not?
I don't know a lot of people in East County who own stock. So the stock market could be doing good, and that might reflect in the GDP, but let's look at the real economy. If the wealthy and well-off are doing well, and that's what we're seeing in the GDP and stock market, then it's business as usual. It's just the wealthier have gotten more wealthy. Mm-hmm. But those of us who are living paycheck to paycheck, who want to live, work, and retire with dignity, ask yourself, don't look at the headline. Look at the trend line of your life. Are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? And if your answer is no, in a big way, then there's still more work to be done to make your life better. And for me, what I want to do is I want to get rid of this tax plan that has jumpstarted the economy for the wealthy, but has stagnated wages for the rest of us. Give tax breaks to small business owners. Give tax breaks to working people, veterans, and seniors, the people who actually spend money in our economy, and not give these big tax breaks for tax cheaters, big corporations mm-hmm. who send our jobs abroad. Flip that and invest in people locally and working people on the ground. I guarantee if you did that, people wouldn't say, look at the GDP, look at the stock market. They'll say, my life is better. I have more, I could sleep better at night. But the fact that people who have no stock are saying, look at the stock market, it just tells you that there's wishful thinking going on.
Along that same vein, the federal deficit, this is, I think, a concern for everybody, no matter what party you're in. It's about to top $1 trillion for the first time ever in our history. Is that at odds with fiscal conservative? I mean, we have a conservative president who ran on saying, let's reduce the deficit. Congressman Hunter, I'm sure, has always said he would have wanted to reduce the deficit, right. And yet it's bigger than it's ever been. Mm-hmm. So the question is, not just is this a bad thing, we probably all agree it is, what programs would you cut, or what means of raising revenues would you support to try to rein in that deficit and bring it under control?
Good question. I guess that makes me more conservative than my opponents, too, because I'm more fiscally responsible than they are. They're just in lockstep with this president. Unbelievable. Like, words mean nothing sometimes at a certain point. Conservative means the opposite of what it used to be. But one thing I would do is the Defense Department. We increase the spending more than the Pentagon asks every single year. So let's give the Pentagon what they want. The second thing is...
what they want, but not more than what they
right.
want.
Right. Not more than what they ask for. We don't need the extra trimmings to give to defense contractors to make a profit off of war. We just don't need that. We need to fund it for to keep us safe and not for profiteering.
Yeah, we should note Congressman Hunter took a lot of campaign mm-hmm. donations from the defense industry.
Right, and he used it for his legal defense, too.
That's right.
But the other thing is, one thing that's costing us a lot of money now, and if we don't find a way to fix it, my generation won't even have the benefits of it, is Social Security and Medicare.
Yeah.
And I don't think that that's the first thing that you hack away at. That's what some people think. And one thing that we can do to make sure that we could fund these programs is raise the cap on income of $137,000 or more to go into Social Security, because mm-hmm. right now it's capped. And I actually had a conversation with one of my opponents, and I will not say his name because it was behind closed doors and we were just talking as people. But he said, you know, it's the wealthy that really contribute the most to Social Security and Medicare. And I'm like, you do know that most wealthy people don't make their income from payroll. You know that because you are actually a wealthy person yourself. And most people who are paying into Medicare and Social Security, it's through their payrolls, through their salaries, it's through their wages. Most wealthy people, their money, their income comes from capital gains and investment. So he knows that he's not being honest and yet still perpetuates this falsehood. So if you actually want to make Social Security and Medicare solvent and actually reduce our deficit and properly fund the federal government for these earned benefits, we have to raise the cap on income above $137,000. We have to make sure that we reward work and not just wealth in this country. And then make sure there's a lot of fraud, waste, and abuse in our government. I saw it firsthand. I worked at the Department of Labor. There were 5,000 people in that building. Not everybody was doing what they needed to be doing. There wasn't enough work to go around. So how do we streamline some of what we do? Bring our federal government into the 21st century. Some of the technology we use is from the 1960s. And if we were to just do those things, we would reduce the spending of our government and spend the money the right way wherever we need to.
And you made a good point. Social Security, this is an earned benefit. We hear entitlement programs. It sounds like we're talking about welfare or somebody, you know, who didn't pay in taking money off the public dole. But with Social Security, we've all paid into it our entire lives if we've been working people. That's what we all anticipated to be there someday when we retire.
Especially my generation. If we don't fix this, we won't have it.
Yeah.
Because every generation is paying back the previous generation.
Good point. Listeners, if you just tuned in, we are speaking again with Amar Campanajar, the Democratic-endorsed candidate running in the 50th Congressional District for the seat formerly held by Congressman Hunter, who resigned after pleading guilty to campaign finance crimes. Amar, you can have the final word. What else would you like our listeners to know today about this race?
Yeah.
And what you would do if you're elected.
Yeah, well, the election's a couple weeks away. That's March 3rd, and we're not just counting the days. We're making every day count. We have an office in Escondido and one in El Cajon. Come help us if you believe in living in a district where we put country over party, where it isn't the left versus the right fighting it out. It's the outsiders versus the insiders in Washington, the political class that we're taking on to reduce the cost of living in our district, to make sure that we could reduce the cost of housing and healthcare and education, that we take on Big Pharma. I'm the only candidate who's actually has a bold plan for that, and use that money to reduce the cost of prescription drugs. I want to protect Medicare and Social Security and create a pathway for the middle class that's not just college, but vocational training. Help me make that a future that's within our reach by going to my website and supporting, going to capandcampaign.com. And we will turn the tide, give this seat back to the people, take it away from a dynasty, finally, and give it back to the people. I know nearly half the district voted for me to be their congressman in 2018. And if you give me a chance, I promise to make you proud. And I'll have a good progress report for us in 2 years. And hopefully you'll reelect me again. But first, let's make this happen. And look, you have an option between me and people who don't live in the district. I think you should support the guy that lives in the district.
Yeah,
I'm from this district, and I promise to serve this district as if your family was my own.
And we should clarify that there are 10 candidates in the race, and it is true that, according to the polls, at least the two other top front runners are not in the district. Mm-hmm. There are some that are. State Senator Brian Jones is in the district. Well, some of the candidates that are polling at 1% or less are in the district. There's also another woman who jumped in at the very last minute, a Democrat, Calderon.
Mm-hmm.
She's polling at a couple of percent from what we could see. But is there a concern that if people don't know and if they split the Democratic vote, does that increase the likelihood that two Republicans could make it into the runoff election in November? Is that something that voters should be concerned or aware of if they're on the Democratic side of the aisle?
I'm not worried about it because we are going to be swinging for the fences, doing the most we can to get out our message. We've been running a 3-year campaign starting from scratch. I don't envy that person who is getting into the race a month before people start voting.
Yeah, and we should note you came within 3 percentage points of defeating Hunter in the last election.
We have the resources, we have the man and woman power, we have the message, and we have the goodwill that we are still carrying over from 2018. There is just no way this seat slips from the people's hands and the people who've invested in this race. So, you know, we could spend all day trying to wonder what the motive is. Moving from the 53rd district to the 50th district literally a month before voting. But honestly, I think when all is said and done, we'll come together. I think my colleague, Calderon, we've talked, and if I win the primary, she's agreed to support me, and I support her in her future endeavors. I just think that it's a little late in the race, but that doesn't mean that she doesn't have a bright future ahead.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Amar, for taking the time to join us here today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you so much.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news from our region.
This is Miriam Raftery, producer of the East County Magazine radio show. If you would like to be the media, here's your opportunity. We're looking for some more talented volunteers for our East County Magazine radio show. So if you've got radio experience or just a great voice, or if you'd like to get experience writing scripts or special reports for the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ, we'd like to hear from you. You can call us at 619-698-7617 or send an email to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We're your community media, bringing you news from our region that reflects the public interest, not special interests.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Royalty Free Music, and Pond 5. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.